Kim and I will be splitting the qualitative modeling piece for this session. So rather than interrupting the flow of the presentation, I'll go ahead and before starting, tell you a little bit about myself. Kim, you know, but I'm a fellow PhD student as well. I'm in my last year of the PhD. My background is in consulting. Spent a number of years consulting, mainly in the U.S., but I've worked on projects all over, and mainly on model-based decision support for both drinking water and wastewater systems. The PhD I'm doing on integrated mathematical and knowledge-based modeling for assessing risk of nitrous oxide production in wastewater treatment plants. So it incorporates this qualitative modeling part, which I've been learning and mastering since I've come to Girona. I've been here 3 years, working with Lekia Group and Kim. Kim is actually the co-PhD supervisor, which is actually being done at Ghent University with the BioMath research group. But I've also, in the process, I've been starting up a company, it's Cobalt Water Global, and mainly focusing on R&D and consulting for sustainable urban water system management. You know Kim, so I won't need to introduce him, but I will say that everything that I know about qualitative modeling has come from him. He's a little bit of a head start in working in the field of qualitative modeling and incorporating artificial intelligence in urban water system decision support. So I think that he's a great person to talk on the topic, lecture on the topic. So without further ado, we'll get started.
Thank you very much, Jose. Yes, the idea of this last session in the morning is that we will talk, so we'll have a short talk about qualitative modeling, Jose and me. Basically, we will present you two specific cases where we have used artificial intelligence techniques to complement deterministic modeling, which is what we have learned in the last two sessions of this morning. And then the last part of this session today is going to be an introduction to the decision support framework given by Jose again, to link with the hands-on exercise of this afternoon. Okay, already you will see that Novedars appears a bit again there. Okay, so these are a bit the contents of this first talk. We'll try to fit on the schedule because it's been quite intensive, so let's try to still finish at 1:15, so we have quite some time to relax and have lunch. Why qualitative modeling? And then we will present these two examples of the qualitative risk model, we call them. So they are models for operational problems that normally they are not described or not well described with deterministic models, which is the ones you have just learned or you know probably more about. So why qualitative modeling? As I said, we're thinking on this type of modeling when we are dealing with some operational problems or some processes, okay? Some processes that take place in wastewater treatment plants. This can be applied, of course, for any other processes in the urban water systems, but let's focus on the wastewater treatment plants. So those operational problems that cannot be described with, for example, ASM1, 2D, 3 models. Okay. For example, I briefly mentioned yesterday about the filamentous bulking problem, or the filamentous foaming problem, or another one is the rising sludge. So these are operational problems that quite often they appear in full-scale wastewater treatment plants, and they are very problematic if they appear. Because, for example, filamentous bulking and foaming both are due to the fact that there is an excessive growth of filamentous bacteria. So I don't know if you can see from there from the picture, but there is a lot of filamentous here together with the flock-forming bacteria. So in the end, we have a type of flock that is not settling well. So it's hinders the good sedimentation of the settling. So what it's causing is that actually the In the worst case, the sludge is not settling. So we have the sludge blanket very high, okay? And with the real risk that we are losing some sludge to the effluent. And then it means that we will have a different SRT as the one that we think we have, and we are calculating, because we think that we are only wasting a sludge from the wasting activated sludge system, but this is not real. We are wasting a sludge through the effluent. But what is worse, it will give us very bad effluent quality. Okay, and then of course we can also have lots of problems due to foaming, which is caused by this filamentous organisms as well. And we can have very bad signals and wrong signals from sensors if they are surrounded by foam of this type of filamentous organisms. And there is another one that already Juan mentioned a little bit, which is another problem that is based on some operational conditions that we can experience during nitrification and identification. We can have N2O production. As I say, basically because of these 2 points, some phenomena, some processes that take place, most of them they have a biological, microbiological origin, okay? An imbalance of the different type of microorganisms. Typically, we would like to have a balance between flock formers and filamentous bacteria, but for some reasons, due to the mostly effluent conditions or operational conditions, we have this balance is broken, and then we experience these problems. Okay, so the problem is that there is a lack of sufficient understanding of the phenomena that are favoring the excessive growth of these filamentous bacteria, for example. But still, there is some knowledge there, basically from experts and from the experience of dealing with these problems in full-scale systems, that the idea is that we could try to take profit of this, okay? There is some knowledge there, even in literature, in bibliography, about what are the conditions that in principle seems to favor these problems, and and how people is dealing with that in full-scale systems. So the idea is, let's try to make use of this knowledge, of this experience, and to incorporate this knowledge into different type of models. And another reason to incorporate qualitative models is because sometimes we don't need complex mechanisms to answer some practical questions or to provide decision support. So sometimes, for some phenomena, yes, we know all the required knowledge in order to be able to describe, for example, the processes with a differential equation. But for some decision support or for to answer some practical questions, maybe this is not needed and we can use a more simple qualitative model. So the thing is that all these problems, since they can, I mean, there is a gap of knowledge there, so we cannot describe that with deterministic models. But there is all this information regarding mostly which are the influent conditions that can favor the development of these problems, and some operational conditions that we can try to take into account. So what we do is to try to represent, to organize all this knowledge in a decision tree fashion, decision tree way, where we evaluate some variables, for example in the effluent, and then we build some reasoning mechanisms the same way that a human expert is doing in order to try to identify these problems at full scale plants. And then once these decision trees are validated by the experts that they know better these problems, they can be easily translated to if-then rules, which will be part of the knowledge base of a rule-based system, for example. There's a lot of information. For example, we can find in books that depending on the loading, kilograms of COD removed per kilograms of suspended solids in the biological reactor and day, in front of the dissolved oxygen in the reactor, we can have this plot where we can be in a safety zone or in a zone where we can have the risk of bulking. Okay, but so what we have done is we have acquired all this knowledge going through the literature after an exhaustive literature review, trying to identify all these sources of information, also talking to the experts, trying to acquire the experience they have it, and try to transfer all this information into a rule-based systems. Regarding N2O, emissions, production and emission, basically is to show you that we have several mechanisms. Juan already talked about, for example, the attempts that are currently being studied in order to identify deterministic modeling. There are some groups all over the world that they are trying to describe the end-to-end production with deterministic models. But Juan said, for example, that they experience quite some problems when applying these models. No? The idea is that as there is standards and widely accepted, generally validated deterministic models for organic matter removal, nitrification, denitrification, and phosphorus removal, there is no yet widely accepted models and generally validated all over the world, for example, for filamentous bulking, and not yet for N2O production. But we can see here that there are some operational conditions that they favor the formation of N2O. So the idea is that also these type of operational conditions, we can represent them by using this type of AI, one of these AI techniques, specifically a rule-based system. Well, these slides, I think, I already introduced yesterday. Basically, we will use some AI techniques, and basically we will be working with this one. For these two case studies, the qualitative risk model for settling problems, for filamentous bulking, foaming, and rising, and the qualitative model for N2O production, we will work with rule-based or knowledge-based systems. So the purpose of these two models is to develop these qualitative models to complement existing deterministic models. So that's the idea. It's not to replace the deterministic model, not at all. The idea is that with the current deterministic models, they are very good, and they have been validated for many different, both pilot scale treatment plants, also full scale plants all over the world for organic matter removal, nitrogen removal, phosphorus removal. But they are not, well, they don't exist basically, for example, for filamentous bulking, for foaming, widely accepted deterministic models. And for N2O production, people are still working on that. We cannot say yet that we have validated models, deterministic models. So we can use this type of, this approach for modeling to complement, and so we will be able to describe more phenomena in the wastewater treatment plan compared to if we don't include these types of models. Specifically about the risk of settling problems. So you see they are quite easy, I mean very simple. We take into account some operational parameters or influent conditions. For example, the ratio of BOD with respect to nitrogen, SRT, etc. Then we explore some, well, this plot is converted to some equations, for example, and we the model will give us an output which is the risk of bulking due to a specific cause. This risk will be given between 0 and 1, being 1 highest risk and 0 the lowest risk. Okay. We have other simple decision trees to identify the risk of filamentous foaming. The other three are decision trees to identify the risk of filamentous bulking. This is for foaming. Each one due to a different cause, for example, which are actually related to different filamentous bacteria. So this is a cause that it is well known already that will favor the development of these organisms, that they will cause foaming, biological foaming. And finally, another one to identify the risk of rising sludge. Rising sludge is when we have reactions in the settler, we have some nitrate, there is some organic matter remaining, so we have denitrification in the settler, so we have reactions in the settler. As Juan said, normally TACACH model doesn't take into account the settling model, the reactions in the settler, but it happens sometimes. If we have, since we have the biomass there, if there is nitrate, we can have denitrification. And then the nitrogen bubbles, basically, they are attached to the sludge, and the sludge can be raised to the surface of the settler as if they were small clouds, okay? And from there, they can reach the effluent. So what we do is a fuzzy implementation of this, let's say, each one of these branches, then they are converted to range. If nitrate in the effluent, concentration in the effluent is higher than a critical concentration, then check the sludge residence time, and if the sludge residence time equals to this value, then check this one, etc. If then rules, they are codified as a rule-based system. And we do that as a FATS implementation. Specifically, we did that, for example, for the benchmark simulation model as well. For some of you that you already know, the benchmark simulation model has a benchmark
and a specific and defined layout with two anoxic and three aerobic reactors, and then we have an specified influent, and we have some performance criteria that are well defined. So what we did basically is to include here, to incorporate, to add an additional model, the knowledge base for this risk of settling problems, and also adding additional criteria. And applying fuzzy logic very quickly, because again, we could spend one course about fuzzy logic, but the idea is that in contrast to the conventional Boolean logic is that things are not black or white, zero or one, but we have a degree, no? Between zero and one, so we have gray. Gray exists, it's not everything black and white. So that's the idea, and for example, this apply it to, to give decision support, we think this is better. And for example, when apply it to example of fever, no? Typically fever, when we have these values, 41 is clearly we have strong fever, but what is the limit? 37.5, 38.1, well, it depends on the person, probably it depends on the doctor, whatever, but the idea is that there is a progressive change between not having not fever and strong fever. And what we do is, so the fuzzy logic allows us to work with these qualitative concepts, which is more similar to the natural language that humans use. Okay, we can use more or less instead of this, I have fever or no fever. For example, and in order to do that, for example, normally we are working in this with models, with deterministic models, we are working in the numerical level. Okay, so our variables or parameters, they have a numerical value. In order to be able to work with these models with linguistic variables, we need to do these processes, fuzzification and defuzzification. Fuzzification means basically converting the numerical values to qualitative values through the process of fuzzification. And then, for example, if we have the plan here, we won't have fever, but we can have, for example, DO value in the biological reactor. So if DO value is 3.7, fuzzification is converting this 3.7 to quite high, for example. Or if it was 0.1, that would be converting it to very low, for example. And then when we have all the variables converted to qualitative values, then we can launch the rule base, which is this set of rule of if-then rules, which codifies the knowledge that we have acquired through the interviews with experts and through the literature review. And then we can get a qualitative value for the output, which would be in this case the risk. And finally, we convert this risk again to a numerical value between 0 and 1. How we convert that? Using what is called Fuzzy membership function, for example. Again, for the example of fever, if we have 38, the idea is that one numerical value can belong to two different groups. Let's say from 0 to 1, I'm going here, and my food fuzzy memberships, they are called, are these ones: low temperature, normal temperature, raised temperature, and strong fever. Okay, so if my fever is 38, I go here and I can say that I belong to the fuzzy membership strong fever with 0.15, and I also belong to the raised temperature with 0.85. Okay, instead of temperature, you can imagine here having, for example, the DO set point or DO value, as I was saying. So we can have, for example, that 2.8 milligrams per liter of dissolved oxygen in the reactor, this could be a little bit high, but mostly normal, for example. And then all the rules within the knowledge base that they have this qualitative value for the DO, a little bit high and mostly normal, they will be launched and they will be activated. So coming back to that, basically, with data coming from influent and operational conditions, we do the fuzzifications. Then when we have converted all the numerical variables to qualitative values, we launch the rules, okay? And we finally do we obtain the risk, and finally with the fuzzification we obtain a value between 0 and 1. Examples specifically for the how to convert F to M ratio, so the loading rate, okay, of wastewater treatment plants
to low values, normal value, high value, very high, or an example to convert SRT, slight residence time, to very low, low, normal, high, very high. And these are the rules, the knowledge base, saying that if SRT is high and food to microorganism ratio is low, for example, then there is a high risk of, in this case, is foaming, risk of foaming, for example.
And then the last part is converting this high risk of foaming to a numerical value between 0 and 1. Well, these are the
steps in order to develop this type of models. We have to do a knowledge acquisition to represent it in a graphical way, because it's very easy to understand, to validate it, then to codify each one of the branches as if then rules, and finally we have this knowledge base. And this is some results just to show you the, for example, the how the risk of filamentous bulking due to the Coe's low F2M ratio is changing along the time in a 1 year simulation. This is using BSM2, for example. So the idea is that with BSM2, the idea is that we complement the information, the criteria that BSM, for example, or models, deterministic models are giving, with this risk of operational problems by using this type of qualitative models. Or, for example, we can compare, as you know, the benchmark simulation models are basically to compare control strategies. Tomorrow you have two lectures about control, and one of the lectures will be very focused on the benchmark simulation models. Basically, it was originally designed to be able to compare different control strategies. What is better, cascade control, or another type of more sophisticated control, or a simple PID control of nitrification and identification. So here again, we have two different control strategies, the gray and the blue, and we see how the system is responding, so we have different risks of these operational problems. So the idea is that with this type of models, we add a third dimension, in the sense that we don't only have information about the effluent quality, okay, COD, nitrogen in the effluent, all of them, they can be integrated into an overall index, which is giving us kilograms of pollutants unit per day, for example. So this integrates COD, nitrogen, total, phosphorus, etc. And not only so effluent quality and cost, but we have a third dimension, which is the risk of operational problems. And what you see here is that, for example, a strategy one that would be good in terms of low effluent quality, so low pollution load being discharged to the river, and cheaper control strategy, would have higher risk of operational problems compared to the other one, which is maybe a bit more expensive, and the effluent quality is not so low, but still maybe could fulfill the requirements in the effluent, but the risk of this operational problem is lower. Okay, and this type of information is something that, if we don't include this axis, this additional criteria could be lost. That's the information we think is important that can be provided by this type of models. And just finally, we also included, what we did was, it's not the reference here, but you can find, it's a water research. What we did is to modify the parameters of the Takacs model. So the Takacs models works well, for example, in general, as an average, works well to describe settling processes if the sludge is well informed, and if it's good sludge settling, let's say. But when there is the problem of sludge bulking, then we have problems for settling, and of course sludge bulking is not well described. Basically because the parameters of the Takacs model, of the settling model, they should be modified. So what we did here was to modify the Takacs model parameters based on the risk of bulking. Basically, when the risk of bulking was higher, the parameters were changed in order to describe better the settling, the settling processes. Describe better, it means actually to be able to describe that the settling processes was worse. And you see here is that the 10 layers of the Takacs models, okay, this axis here is a simulation time, and you see that between days, I don't know, 300 and 500, we have higher concentrations here in layers, in the top layers. Layer 1 would be actually the surface. And in the worst case, we have some sludge in the surface, so leaving the settler and increasing the concentration in the effluent, which was something that could not be described with the conventional Takacs model, because we see here that this concentration is not affected. So that was the first case, the risk model of settling problems, and now I will pass the word to Jose to describe the second one, which is the risk model of N2O. Okay.
So considering the time, we want to try to make lunch on time. I might go through it a little bit quicker than originally anticipated, but if you have any questions, feel free to ask afterwards during lunch or even tomorrow and the following day during the hands-on exercise, the role-playing game. We are going to be incorporating the N2O risk model a bit. So there's going to be opportunity to actually apply some of this knowledge. So there again, more questions might come up, so feel free to ask at any point. But essentially, the risk of nitrous oxide was inspired by the previous case study that Keen presented, mainly because we saw a lot of parallels, complex microbial phenomena, a significant amount of knowledge from literature existed on the topic, no widely validated and accepted mathematical models, and clear operational parameters that have been associated and linked to the risk of nitrous oxide production in the literature. Therefore, it was a valid approach to look at nitrous oxide production. And why do we care about nitrous oxide? If you don't know already, it's a very strong greenhouse gas. So if you're worried about the carbon footprint of the wastewater treatment plant, it can actually make up the majority of it. It doesn't take a lot to raise the carbon footprint. It's a strong ozone depleter. And to date, there really hasn't been anything done about the nitrous oxide production and emissions in wastewater treatment plants. And that's partly due because there hasn't been tools. But now we've gotten to the point where we have enough knowledge, we have tools, and measuring them directly is fairly easy as well. So we've basically reached the point where there really is no excuse to not look at your nitrous oxide production in wastewater treatment plants. So in terms of the approach for doing this, it's basically following the same approach as looking at the risk of settling problems, where we develop a knowledge base. So the knowledge acquisition step, go dive into the literature, look at experience in terms of operational parameters linked to nitrous oxide production, then coding this knowledge in a fuzzy logic rule-based system, and looking at different risk factors, producing risk for different factors due to nitrite, for example, low dissolved oxygen, and other risk factors. But this mainly works by introducing either online data, like the SCADA data, or simulation output data from mathematical models. And these are all the risk factors that we developed. There's quite a few, but we're really focusing on the ones that are, most familiar to wastewater treatment plant operators. For example, the dissolved oxygen. Also, nitrite, there's been very strong correlation with that, so we wanted to take a close look at the nitrite. But we're looking at this for both the nitrification and the denitrification process. And Kim showed the diagram of the different pathways. So there's various pathways for both processes, nitrification and denitrification. So we're looking at both. For nitrification, we're mainly concerned with N2O production via AOB denitrification, so the nitrifier denitrification, ammonia oxidizing bacteria, but also from incomplete hydroxylamine oxidation, so converting the ammonia to nitrite in that first step in the nitrification process, you have the potential for producing N2O as an intermediate. And heterotrophic denitrification, that can be hindered through a variety of ways and producing N2O, again, as an intermediate. So just to kind of check that we're addressing all of the relevant pathways, we can bring up this diagram again and just check. So we're looking at dissolved oxygen, so high dissolved oxygen, we're addressing the pathway for N2O from denitrification, but also looking at low dissolved oxygen, again, we're incorporating the potential for N2O production from nitrification. And in the denitrification process, we're looking at, again, dissolved oxygen, nitrite, and COD. So all of these we were looking at. So essentially, by focusing on those risk parameters, we are addressing all the relevant pathways for nitrous oxide production. So to sort of test this concept, as Kim mentioned, there's the BSM platform. So this is a perfect place to test the concept because it's essentially a virtual platform. You don't have to do anything with a real plant, and serves as a way of comparing different control strategies. So we wanted to look at two different control strategies. One would be more of a traditional control strategy, maintaining a constant dissolved oxygen in your aerobic reactors of 2 milligrams per liter, and one in where you're reducing that to 1.3, which would be representative of a energy saving measure by reducing the aeration. And by looking at the criteria, again here we essentially were able to provide a third dimension to the effluent quality and the operational cost indices, and looking at the risk of nitrous oxide production. So we saw that by lowering the DO set point, we increased the period under high N2O risk to almost 100% of the time. And we saw that you did save some in operational costs, but not that much. So in terms of decision support, this helps this on deciding on whether or not to go with this type of control strategy. So one might think that, well, we're not really saving that much, but we're increasing the risk of nitrous oxide production, so it's not really worth it. So looking at things further, we were able to actually identify where the problem was, and we identified a problem reactor here. So by being able to look at the simulation results for each of the reactors, we can identify where the problem is. And so once we proved this concept, we wanted to get a sense of whether or not this is valid with real data. So we went and measured at the Quart treatment plant, which is almost walking distance. We were tempted to actually walk with the equipment, but we figured it'd just be better to drive. But we saw that the liquid, we measured the nitrous oxide in the liquid and also in the gas, and in both cases we saw the risk model performed very well. And again, this is a qualitative model, so the first goal is to have the model predict high risk when your emissions are higher. But if you actually see it corresponding dynamically with the emissions, then it's more of a bonus. And this is actually what we're seeing here. It corresponds dynamically fairly well. The other thing that we're seeing is that by looking at the different risk factors, which implicate the different pathways for N2O production, we're seeing that the risk results actually tell us something about the likely pathways for producing. And this is helpful for identifying mitigation strategies. So in this case, we saw that really the main pathway that was prompted or is likely implicated is the AOB denitrification pathway. Because the risk due to hydroxylamine oxidation is zero all of the time. So this is the orange here. So it's clear that the risk is likely due to the oxygen limited conditions. So we had plenty of data to look at. So we thought we'd look at data from the Netherlands, or the Aalrikstel wastewater treatment plant. And here we saw similar results, and also saw that how well the nitrite risk corresponded with the actual N2O production. So that's the green. The measured N2O is the blue. We also saw that the risk due to low dissolved oxygen was more or less corresponding. So it was higher when the emissions were higher and lower when the emissions were lower. And again, it was telling us that this was likely due to AOB denitrification, because the risk factors implicating AOB denitrification were corresponding, whereas the ones for hydroxylamine oxidation were not. So we had also more data in the Netherlands looking at Eindhoven, and we saw similar results. And here we actually compared the results to a mathematical model for nitrous oxide production. And here we can see, is this the pointer?
No,
it doesn't work.
Oh.
But how do you move it?
Not sure.
You can't move it.
Mm-hmm. Mouse maybe? Anyway, I use this pointer. But here we saw the different risk factors. So high DO risk, which implicates the hydroxylamine oxidation pathway, and the low in the red, low DO risk, which implicates the AOB denitrification pathway. And we saw the measured N2O, which is the light blue, corresponding with the risk results. The darker blue is the mathematical model results, and we see that it is more or less describing the N2O production here, but not really the N2O production here. So in this case, you could say that the risk model was able to better represent the risk of nitrous oxide production for the two pathways, because what we're seeing here is N2O being produced from both pathways, because we have both DO conditions, high DO and low DO. So going a step further, we wanted to look at this, test this N2O risk-based control by looking at the model. So we modeled the current control, which was producing these risk peaks for both the high DO and the low DO. And then we looked at a case where essentially we're eliminating the risk. We're selecting, purposely selecting a set point that results in zero risk. And you can see this with the zero risk results here. But then we compared the effluent quality for both scenarios to see if we could maintain the ammonia and the effluent, if we could meet the ammonia criteria. And basically what we see here is that it was more or less maintained. It didn't really make a big impact. So it wasn't compromising the effluent quality. So here, in terms of decision support, one can say that if we can mitigate the risk of N2O and maintain our effluent quality, it's more basically a no-brainer. Why not? And in this case, you can even see that during the periods of high DO, you're eliminating these periods where you're essentially over-aerating. So you might even save operational cost as well. And here's a summary of, I guess, some of the IWA cost-related items to the risk models, and some conclusions from looking at the two risk models. So what we're seeing is that with both types of risk models, we have an added value. So we're not just able to look at effluent quality and operational cost, but we can look at other things that are critical that the deterministic models cannot describe. So before we jump into the decision support frameworks, we can take one or two quick questions.
Yeah. In the SPARC simulation model number 2, for example, I see that when you finish the simulation, you get the question if you want to activate a specified model. And then you calculate the risk of elementous bacteria, for example. But in this case, it's not real-time feedback, right?
No.
When you're simulating, yeah.
Yeah, it's calculated the same way that as the other performance criteria. So when you have
when the simulation is stopped and you have the simulation outputs, then you
know how we have
yeah, like Epsilon quality operational cost index are calculated after the simulation. So the same way the these risk criteria are calculated. But there was an implementation, the one that provided the risk model implementation that we used in order to modify the settling parameters, of course that had to be calculated, let's say, during the simulation online. So there is that simulation, that implementation also exists. But it's not the typical one that is distributed when somebody asks for the VSM. It is also not this implementation was not optimized, eh? So probably you could work on it to make it faster. But the first implementation that Xavi did actually, Xavi Flores, to calculate it during the simulation, to use it as a control parameter, that was slowing, slowing down the simulation.
I think it depends upon the platform, because Fortran doesn't modify.
Yeah, that was in MATLAB.
Yeah, but in MATLAB, I don't know if you use the MATLAB fuzzy tool or...
I don't think it's... Yeah, at the beginning, MATLAB has several toolbox, and there is one fuzzy logic toolbox. Mm-hmm. The first implementation of the RISC model was using this fuzzy toolbox, but that means that anybody who wanted to try it, they needed all the toolboxes from MATLAB, so in order to avoid that, we did a... another implementation that actually wasn't needed. I mean, you can still do fuzzification, defuzzification, but without using the toolbox. No? You just need a little bit more of programming, but that was made. It's already now exists without the fuzzy toolbox.
Yeah, and here we've been talking about the application of these risk models in what I would say is an offline application. But I mean, when we see the risk results corresponding dynamically as well as they have, we've also started looking at online implementation. So this would be more of a dynamic application where it's basically in real time. So looking at the conditions and diagnosing the risk in real time and then making decisions based on that, control actions or alarms.
Can you say the risk model for the production is the same as for the emission of NGO?
No, but they're closely related. So this is risk of production, if that wasn't clear. Because we're looking at the parameters that are linked to the production. But once you have the production, depending on your conditions, your specific conditions at the treatment plant, you're going to be emitting that. So a lot of times, again, it all depends on your treatment plant. The production is, looking at the risk of production is basically the same as looking at the risk of emissions. But that may or may not be necessarily the case in all situations, because you have production and anoxic zones where you're not aerating. So if you're not aerating, you're not going to be emitting at that location. It'll be downstream. So it's not risk of emission, but closely related.
Let's move to the last part, Jose.
Yeah. So just to kind of recap of what we've been covering to date, yesterday, Kim presented on DSS in wastewater treatment. Luis talked about LCA. Today, you've heard about mechanistic modeling and also now qualitative modeling. So in a way, you can look at each of these parts as tools for looking at wastewater treatment and tools for providing decision support. So now we want to talk about these in the context of a framework, a decision support framework. So we'll be distinguishing what's the difference between a DSS and a DSS, DS framework, decision support framework. Also discussing why we need a sustainable urban water system decision support framework. And we'll look at some examples of these frameworks. And that's right, we'll have a quiz at the end. So what does that mean? That means no sleeping, no daydreaming, no thinking about how much you missed your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, or wife. So we'll be asking questions at the end and making sure you've been paying attention. So the first definition that we want to cover is the decision support system. And the decision support system is basically a tool or a combination of tools or an ICT system implemented for assessing and evaluating system conditions based upon a given set of input data. And as we talked about before, this could be either offline or online. Now, decision support framework, does anyone want to take a guess as to what a decision support framework is? Yes?
Maybe the complex implementation of DSS?
The complex?
Like integration of these tools?
Yes.
Into a framework?
It's essentially what it is. You're integrating the tools, but you're also looking at other things to be able to, in the end, give you this decision support. But there's also a couple of other key things that we want for this framework. So basically, it's a structured and systematic implementation of processes, procedures, and tools. So there could be a lot of processes and procedures in place that might allow you to use these tools. Because the tools are just tools, so you can't just have a tool and be able to get automatically decision support. Now you have to feed data into the tool. And to feed data into the tool, you have to have data management. But this is also to extract the data, assess and evaluate the system conditions like the DSS does for various scenarios, and do this on an ongoing or programmatic basis. And this is the key. So we don't want to do this just one time, because if you're just doing it one time, it doesn't really matter how structured or how systematic you are. As long as you get the data, you can run the tool, you get your answer, and that's it. But the thing is with urban water systems is that they're not static. So chances are you're going to have to do this again for different reasons. And if you don't have this structured a systematic way, it's going to be too labor intensive, and it's just not going to get done after one or two times. So I have a question here. Can a DSS also be a decision support framework? I'm sorry?
It would take part of the
Yeah, it could make up part. Yes, certainly in some instances it can make up part of the DS framework, decision support framework. But could it also be the decision support framework?
No.
No? Okay. So we'll think about that. Just keep that in mind. Maybe the question will come up again. So the components of a decision support framework are essentially these shown here. But you have your data sources. You have a data repository where you're bringing all the data sources to. You have your tools and your models. You have your scenario analysis. And in the end, you have an evaluation of these results and essentially what gives you the decision support based on the criteria that you're interested in or looking at. But you can basically break this up into three more fundamental components, and that's the data management part, There's the assessment part, which includes the tools and the scenario analysis, and then the evaluation and decision support part. And this could even be iterative. Based on your evaluation, you might want to go back and look at other scenarios until you find something that you think works for you. And it's also important to sort of set boundaries on what is exactly decision support and what is decision making, because I see the two confused a lot, because the decision making is really done by humans. And for effect, I show Donald Trump here. But the decision support is what gives us the ability or the support, the information that we need to actually make the decision. It's not decision making. So within the boundaries, you see the like DSS and decision support framework within for the decision support, and then the decision making is really for the humans, the decision makers. Now, even with the best decision support, I don't know that I would trust Donald Trump with making decisions, but hopefully we won't have to. So why do we need a sustainable urban water system decision support framework? So anyone want to guess? Any answers? Yes?
Because some systems won't work under various circumstances. You need to be sure what's working in which case and whatnot. And then you can exclude some alternatives that won't work in because of this reason.
Yes. So this kind of goes back to what I was saying, that urban water systems are not static. So they can change different things. There's different things that change them, different scenarios that will change them. So that we're thinking about whether they're future scenarios, but to, I guess, rule out scenarios, you need this framework to be able to look at these scenarios. But I guess another reason is because business as usual is not sustainable. And we need to incorporate sustainability into our decision support. So basically, traditionally, decision support has existed for a long time. We've looked at the effluent quality and the operational cost, but incorporating sustainability into that decision making is relatively new. So if we want to be sustainable, it needs to be incorporated. So that's why it's important to have a sustainable decision support framework that incorporates it. Another reason is because we need this structured and systematic way of leveraging the data, assessing the system and evaluating the conditions for different scenarios on a continuous basis. Again, it's this continuous basis that's important. And if we're not continuously looking at our situation, we don't know how we're doing sustainability-wise. So if we don't know how we're doing, we can't improve. So another reason I mentioned before that the urban water systems are not static. So here on the left are listed factors that can affect urban water systems in terms of decision-making, or what might prompt a certain level of decision making. And we have the basic levels here in the right columns. And basically you can see each of these factors can implicate decisions at any of these levels. So population increases, or if there's further development, then we gotta revisit the existing systems. The water use, and ultimately what's going to drive the sustainability of the urban water cycle is the end users, how they use water. So if they're not conserving, they're not reusing water, that's going to have a different sustainability result on the urban water cycle. So here's other things listed here. Essentially they can be objectives or things like legislation. If your permit discharge limits change. Now you got to go back and revisit your situation. So we'll look at a couple of examples of sustainable urban water system decision support frameworks. And here's this Wachlin project that's being administered by the German Agency for International Cooperation, or GIZ, and also IWA. And WACLIM stands for Water and Wastewater Companies for Climate Mitigation. And they're working with partners and partner utilities in developing countries, specifically in Thailand, Peru, and Mexico, and also now Jordan. And basically working with these utilities and helping them to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and be more carbon neutral, and incorporating this into their day-to-day operations. And one of the things that have resulted from the project is sort of looking at all the different pieces to this. So there's a tool also developed, which actually was developed at ICRA, a web-based tool. It's called ECAM. So there's the tool, there's the data. So obviously a lot of these utilities are interested in saving and operational costs. And then there's the objective of reducing the greenhouse gas emissions. But what we really want to do is integrate all of these pieces into a framework so that they can do it on a continuous basis, monitor their greenhouse gas emissions and see if they're actually improving. So if they don't have a framework, they can't do that. So here we show this greenhouse gas data management and mitigation framework, where they have the data sources on the far left, the central data repository in the green, where they're bringing all of the data sources to, and then from here they're extracting the data to run the tool, get their results here in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions, and also they're also looking at performance indicators based on different metrics. And then based on this, they can start to see where they can actually reduce and look at, evaluate different alternatives for reducing their emissions. So we've actually developed a decision support framework for looking at different alternatives. But that, I guess you could say, is part of the overall framework. Here we show a sustainable drinking water distribution system support, decision support framework. And this is for a system that I worked on in Texas. And they had a distribution system model that we had helped them develop and calibrate, and they wanted to use for various purposes and use it for planning for their operations. And here we can see the different things that are connected to the model. So they're looking at demand and growth projections. They're looking at their firefighting capacity in the distribution mains, and they're just looking at they're also looking at their typical performance, the water quality, the pressure, and also the energy. Energy is becoming more and more important, and the distribution system model gives you all of the information that you need to be able to calculate that for various scenarios. But then they have everything this. Routed through essentially their GIS database. So here the GIS serves as this data repository for them. And we're looking at I know this is a course for wastewater treatment, sustainable wastewater treatment, but I think it helps to look at other types of systems for inspiration. I always get inspiration from looking at other disciplines, so that would be good to look at this. So we also have this decision support framework for the Eindhoven wastewater treatment plant that we're working on. And to start, we wanted to look at what their objectives were, because you're always going to be building your decision support framework based on your objectives, because it doesn't make sense to develop a decision support framework if it's not going to give you decision support for meeting your objectives. So here on the left column here, we see the objectives and their current control strategies for different various processes. And we were looking to see with the green whether they had a positive effect on their objectives, and you can see a lot of green here, which is good. If it's all red, then there would be problems. But there are some red going to things like N2O, because these control strategies were originally developed without N2O in mind. So we're looking at ways to kind of balance this and looking at new control strategies by just making simple adjustments. These are these in green. So here we're taking guesses as to what would be providing a positive effect or a potential negative effect or something we don't know. We won't know until we actually simulate that scenario. So in terms of the simulation, we have all of the scenarios here on the left, and color-coded, you can see which models, because there's different models that are used to answer different questions for the Eindhoven system. So they have an integrated model that looks at the sewer treatment plants and river water quality. They also have a plant-wide model, and now we've incorporated the N2O risk model into the decision support. So here you can see their evaluation criteria that they're interested in. And then we came up with this decision support system for online wastewater treatment plant supervision and control. And this one was incorporating the risk model for settling problems, but also the risk model for nitrous oxide. And we were also looking at, conceptually, a risk model for looking at resource recovery technology that would be implemented at the treatment plant. So here we see the same risk modeling framework, but now in an online environment, we see the evaluation criteria that is being looked at on a real-time basis to give us real-time answers. We have the SCADA data, and we have a model connected to this, which is not for real-time modeling, but for modeling the current situation, which without this framework, you wouldn't be able to do. Now going back to the question before, whether a DSS can be a decision support framework, anyone want to guess whether this DSS would be a decision support framework? The answer is yes. The answer is yes, because we have all the different components in here. Even though it's on an online environment, all the components are here. So in this particular case, the DSS can be the decision support framework. So now we'll basically be introducing the tool that you're going to be working on, because you can build a decision support framework around the tool. But I think we can continue this after the lunch, because then you'll be able to work with the tool immediately after. I think that might be able to get a better grasp of what the tool does, what's intended to do. So we can stop here, but before we go, the moment everyone's been waiting for. Quiz time. So, anyone have the answer to this question? What is the difference between a decision support system and a decision support framework? Yes.
So maybe the decision support systems are like the product. And decision support framework like deals with these processes and also visualize this data to be able to perceive them better, you know, for the decision.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I guess another way to look at it is also what you mentioned before, where the framework integrates everything, whereas the decision support system is just a tool. So you have cases, the DSS can be a framework if it has all the components, but it also might not be. It might just be a tool. And we just answered this question. So everyone gets a bonus point here. But what about this one? Can someone give an example of where a DSS is a decision support framework?
If we deal with one problem.
I'm sorry?
If we deal with one, you know, particular problem.
Where the DSS can be the decision support framework?
Yes. Or maybe I can say, but if you
I guess the easy answer would just be this one. So this is an example of where the decision support system is also a decision support framework. So basically any decision support system that has all of the components needed to give you that decision support, so the data management, the assessment, the evaluation, so all of that's being done here.
So the one we will work this afternoon is a DSS or a DSA, decision support framework? I mean for them, because they will learn it well and they will be playing with it. So.
I was going to wait till later.
Ah, okay.
To answer it.
We will ask after the session this afternoon.
Yeah, but I think if after going through this, I think you should be able to answer it yourself. But we'll see if you're paying attention. So the next question is, what are the three components needed in a decision support framework? Or what are three components? You can break it down to three simple ones, or there could be more detailed ones. Yes?
It's the data, the assessment of the data, and in the end, evaluation by some criteria you chose before.
Yes, very good. Any other?
Is it the same?
The same? Why do we need a sustainable decision support framework? So we discussed a few different reasons. So just one we're looking for here.
There are two ideas in that.
I'm sorry?
There are two ideas for that question. The first one is that we need to have sustainability in the business part.
Yes.
And the second one is that we need to do this framework. We need to do it in a way that it's systematic and structured for the three components that we talked before.
Yes, yeah, very good. Yeah, because if it's not systematic or structured, it's only going to happen once or twice, and then it's probably never happen again because it's too much work. And that's it. Any good questions?